Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prashtaya Bhutale Shimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nitinamine. I thank you all very much for participating in this call, where we will try to create a community by confronting the question of our own, let us say, being bound by time, our own temporal existence. Sometimes it is said that in for spiritual realization, it is extremely helpful to engage with the question of death, because strangely enough, when you look at death, your own immortality can shine forth. It was Gandhi who said that life and death are like two small caskets, which each one containing the key that opens the other casket. So if we can penetrate into the question of death, we can open the casket of life, or we can penetrate to the depths, the casket of life. If we can really enter this and live it to the fullest, we will be able to solve the mystery of death. Each one of these contains the key that opens the secret of the other. I will be sharing today with you a very thought-provoking experience, and afterwards how I discussed this experience with the doctor. It was in the year 2012 when I finally decided to go for a surgery on my legs. I had very strong varicose veins on the right leg and mild varicose veins on the left. And when the doctor saw me in the first time, he said, "Good that you come now, because you, this illness, this malady has developed to stage 5. There is no higher stage, and we need to remove the big vein, which starts, you know, where the legs join the body and go right down to the feet." I said, "Can you please do it on both legs?" Because for me it was an surgery I was not so happy with, because I somehow had it in my mind that varicose veins, or the removal of them, is more a beauty operation, and I don't care for this. I'm a monk. I don't need to be beautiful outside. I need to develop inner effulgence and inner beauty. So I was not comfortable with it, but my friends have told me this can develop into thrombosis, where blood clots form and move into the brain, and then you really are in a very, very difficult situation. So, yes, I struggled with the question, should I have the surgery or not? So, finally, the doctor convinced me. I went and saw him just before the surgeon's theater, the operation theater. He put with a marker black lines on wherever there were veins that needed to be removed. And he said, "We will only do one leg. You will know why. This is not a small surgery. You will suffer if we do two at once. You just follow us, please." So I had wanted to have the two legs treated, but they said no, one at a time. I remember the surgery, nothing of the surgery. I had a full narcosis. When I woke up, I was in my room in the hospital. And in the evening, the surgery had been in the morning. I was already able to walk with pain, with the help of two of my very close friends who were holding me left and right. I was walking because they told me, walk immediately after the surgery because the blood needs to find new channels and develop them into proper veins. And everything was going according to plan. 2 days later, I was released from the hospital. I went to the town of Heidelberg. That's near Frankfurt. And I walked every day like they had told me, but then the pain started to increase. It became so bad that on one walk, I could only walk with assistance. I fainted and fell into the arms of my assistant. He brought me back into the apartment where I was staying. And I had said, well, you have to go through the pain. But the pain increased hour by hour. I could finally not move any longer on my own. I needed to be carried to the bathroom, and there was no point of using a bathing tub. No, for the functions of evacuation, I had to be carried and then brought back. And finally, I fainted for a long time, and my assistant, who had gone to do some shopping, came back and immediately carried me into the car and brought me back to the hospital. If I would have been alive, I would not have gone, because, when you once go through surgery, you just intuitively don't want to go again. You are afraid. Your body memory is telling you, don't enter that room again, the operation theater. It's dangerous. Everything in me would have revolted, but because I was in a fainted condition, I was brought back, and I was immediately brought to the doctor, I remember, who had done surgery for me. He had been called from his home to see me. He was out of station, and he did a few checks, and he said, "Oh no, our patient has contracted sepsis." Now, for those of you who are not surgeons, at least in a German hospital, this is the cause for people dying. They get an infection, it's an infection, and then I once heard every third or fourth patient who catches this type of infection has to die. And my case was very difficult because I had been released from hospital. I had stayed for days away from any antibiotics and anything. And when, because I didn't know, I thought it's natural that there is some pain in the after surgery. And when I came back, they immediately said, we have to put as much antibiotics into your body as you can take. And I was immediately put on intravenous feeding. These days which I spent in the hospital, I have not much remembrance because I was falling into a coma and coming out of it. I would sometimes see people around my bed. I was struggling for dear life until finally my doctor, Professor Heger, said, we have done everything we can for you. The night the coming night will decide whether you live or whether you will die.
Wow.
In the evening, 10 o'clock, his assistant, a very cultured lady who actually wanted to be an opera singer and knew all the classical books of and with whom I had talked, because I'm a lover of literature. She came and she said, I came to say goodbye just in case I don't see you tomorrow morning. You have the worst type of sepsis in a very advanced degree. Professor Heger told me, and then she started to cry and said, you're such a good man, please don't go. I remember, do I have a choice? I remember saying this, do I have a choice? She was so affectionate, please don't go. Then Professor Heger came. They were both on my bed and he said, I have thought and thought and thought. We cannot do anything for you any longer. But you are a monk, so maybe you want to pray. But if you have ever prayed and if you believe in prayer, you need to do it now. By medical standards, you will not see the sunrise tomorrow. And then he also started to cry. So I understood these good people were really worried. Not even, they were beyond worried. They had given me up. They came to say goodbye. So when they left the room, I said, well, one last thing. Dr. Heger, I remember he returned, what? Please take me off morphine as much as you can, because the pain had become so intolerable that they needed to sedate me. I said, I need to confront my death, if it is to come, with all my faculties intact. So they said, are you sure it will be painful? I said, see, there's another pain than physical pain. There is the mental pain, and we might take that into our next life, the pain that I have not lived up to my potential, the things which I could do. So they said, Okay, we. They said like this. Let us take it off. But then Professor Heger said, "I will stay with you for another hour, and you we can monitor. Maybe you need a little." So he put me off the morphium. You know, it's given intravenously, as far as I remember. And then after 1 hour, it was just so intolerable that I said, please increase the doses a little bit, but I need to be fully awake. And I remember, my dear audience, what I'm sharing with you is, where I think about it, it was very difficult. I couldn't lie on the back, I couldn't lie on the right side, I couldn't lie on the left side. There was no question of turning on the belly because of all the intravenous feeding. And I was just not, and the nerves were on fire. I think you all know sometimes things can get on our nerves and we are very restless, but multiply this times, I don't know, 100 maybe, then you have my condition. I was just, the nerves were, I was not in the normal state of mind or consciousness. And then I tried everything. I know a lot of breathing exercises where you can disconnect for some time from the perceptions in the body. I know all the, you know, we monks have a lot of tools which we have learned in our tradition. But if I'm very honest with you, they worked for some time, but then this severe state of being absolutely ill at ease returned. Professor Heger, who said, I have to go now, I have to do another surgery, said, more morphium or less. I said, I go with this doses because I'm fully conscious. He said, your choice. Then after some time, I can't tell you exactly when, I came into a very different state of consciousness. I would call it an altered state of consciousness. And I all of a sudden saw that somehow I picked up speed. You might say, you were in your bed. How could you pick up speed? Yes, I felt there was a suction, a pulling force that was pulling my inner self very quickly. And all of a sudden I saw myself in a tunnel. There was a little light there coming from the walls, but very dim light. And I started to move faster and faster and accelerate more and more. And I knew what this is. This is what in near-death experiences have been called. You move through the tunnel, and what in Sanskrit is called the nadis. There are 18,000 nadis which extend from the heart, through which the soul can leave the body at the time of death. I knew this. I thought, oh my God, is this is the end? I'm leaving my body through these exit ways. You can imagine it like this. Imagine you sit in a theater, it's absolutely dark, and then there is alarm, fire alarm, and all of a sudden, some exits will will start to blink at you. Blink, 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 meaning take this exit. So I also felt all of a sudden this tunnel being a little lit, and I was pulled into it. And I picked up speed, speed, speed. It was so fast, like maybe an airplane taking off the runway, and going faster and faster and faster and faster. So in the same way, I picked up the speed, and then I saw at the end some very, very bright light, but small, a point of bright light, and I raced towards this. And as I reached it, it was as if coming out of a tunnel with great speed, and I found myself in a great ocean of light, or mass of light is a better word, a great mass of light, and there was no pain. There was absolutely no worry. I was floating in a zone of the greatest imaginable relief. I didn't see anything within that light. Then all of a sudden, my spiritual training came back to me. Wait a minute, I thought. I have preparing in my spiritual practices to enter a spiritual world with variety, but here I'm in the midst of light, undifferentiated light. At that moment, I saw that the light was coming from a place which I didn't see. It was a little bit like, imagine a door opens for just a little bit, like this, and you see light falling through that little space into a dark room and filling it up. So it was a little like this. But it was very nice. And then I heard a little voice inside and said, it said, please take rest here. You will not die this time. You are now welcome in the place of no pain, of no sensation. Take a little rest. Let your wearied soul recharge itself in this light. And I asked, but what is behind the door? And the voice came back and said, not yet, not yet, not yet. It's not yet for you to go there. So I rested a little bit. I became very joyful. Ari knows me as a joyful person. I'm also, you will be surprised, I like sacred dance, and I'm a passionate dancer and sacred dance. So I felt like the joy of being in a sacred dance without dancing. There was no movement. There was just being in that state. So, but joyous being. And the next thing I remember, I don't know how long this lasted on. I remember I woke up in the hospital bed. It was totally wet, the bed, from sweat. All the intravenous needles, which were here and here, were no longer there. There was a little blood here and there, and I could see the blood on the hospital bed. And after some time, I saw the nurse just opening the door a little bit and looking. And I said, "Why are you? Are you afraid of me? Why are you not coming in?" She had been. We had talked. There was a young person, and she had asked me about spiritual things. So I said, "Why are you not coming?" And she very hesitatingly entered the room. "Why do you look like this at me?" And she said, "I have never seen this in my life. You were laughing, you were crying, you were... I have heard description of ecstasy. I think you were in ecstasy. Could it be?" And the Professor Heger, the main doctor, had said, "Let him be. Whatever he does in that night, it is his night. Let him be. He is something else than we people. He is a monk, and you let him be. It is his good right. He will live, or he will be dead in the morning. You let him be." So I didn't do anything. I didn't call anything. You were just moving. You were so, your body was going through very different movements than I have ever seen before. And how are you, by the way? I said to the nurse, something which would translate an American idiomatic language, "I'm great." In German, you would say, "Ich fühle mich so großartig wie nie zuvor in meinem Leben." It's a little bit longer than "I'm great." I felt so happy still. I was a little exhausted, but I could see the disease which had invaded me like a foreign army had left. It had been taken from me, and I was very elated. And you know, when you have conquered, the Greeks say, when you come into a crisis, a medical crisis, it's that turning point where the patient will either recover or he will die. And I had been in this crisis in the night, and I had taken the road to recovery and felt very, very good. Of course, I was weak and all this, but I had won the battle. This is how I felt. I cannot express to you how happy the Professor Heger was, and how happy his assistant were. But I also saw some reservedness in them, and I did not know why they were all of a sudden reserved. 2 days later, I was discharged. I have one student who is a medical person. That student came and took care of the bandages and the wounds which had been there after the surgery, and nursed me, gave me the soup I could eat again, and brought me back to health. I came twice to Professor Heger, who looked at the wounds, if everything was healing, who did also blood tests, if the sepsis really was gone, but he remained reserved. Then he invited me for a final check. It was 14 days after I was released. And I came, and he did his routine, you know, investigating everything, and I said, Professor Heger, your behavior towards me changed. Why? And Professor Heger looked at me with that searching glance, you know, can I speak or can I not speak? Like this. And he then said, okay, I will tell you, I'm afraid of you. Why? Well, you could sue me. The mistake was mine. Somehow the instruments I used must have carried bacilli. You know, this is do you understand bacilli in you know, the plural number of something like it's not a virus, but it's something like that. Infection, the things which carry infections. And many times doctors have been sued, and some have lost their profession, you know, when people survived what you had. So I must say, I was afraid, and I'm even now a little afraid. Then why do you tell me that I can sue you? Well, you will find out anyways, you know, if you do a little investigation into this. I said, Professor Heger, sit down now. I never ever thought of finding fault in you, because you only did your best. You are a good person. You didn't want to, you don't want to create harm to for your patients. I have enough knowledge of the human mind. You know, I speak with many people. You only did your best. And second of all, I feel it was unavoidable. Everyone gets what they are meant to get in this life. There, if I don't get it in one way, I get my karmic reactions to what I have done, and either in this life or the life before, I get it anyways. I have come, I told him, to accept miseries and happiness as part of life. They come on their own without being pursued by me. They come because I caused them. And this understanding has given me peace, deep peace in my mind. I don't think you are the cause of my sepsis. You tried everything to do surgery on me, and because, you know, we had become somewhat friends, I had confessed to him that before I became a monk, I was a Rolling Stones fan, and he was also a Rolling Stones fan before he became a doctor, and we exchanged our appreciation for this type of music, and we had talked personally to each other. How long all this is away? 50 year, plus years I'm separated from that type of life. It seems to me like a dream, a distant dream, but I do still have recollections of some parts of the dream before I became a monk. So I shared with him that I see things differently. I see that happiness and distress come. And I told him something which I yearn to share with you. I told him an ancient, from an ancient scripture. Some of you will know it's the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's a book of pristine spiritual wisdom. We find there a brahmana, he's like a priest, who had land and cattle, a family, but who somehow lost everything. Even his family and relatives left him, seeing him a poor and downtrodden person. He became a monk whose only possession was a begging bowl. But he could not live in peace as a monk. Whenever people spit at him, people cut jokes, they said, "You were once so rich, and now because you are maybe want to become even more rich and you're so stingy, therefore you go out with a begging bowl and you beg from us poor people," and they gave him such an ill treatment, insults which I'm too shy to repeat here. And finally, when his begging bowl was stolen from him, he sat down and he sang a song which is very, very deep. I will quote to you some lines of the song. He said, "These people are not the cause of my happiness and distress. My own body is not the cause of my happiness and distress. The planets which form in certain astrological constellations are also not the cause of my happiness and distress. Nor is time, the passage of time which brings us happiness and then separates us from happiness, the cause of my happiness and distress. The cause of my happiness and distress is my mind. Only my mind sees happy, which is identified with the body and which has forgotten that I'm an eternal soul. I'm part of the Supreme. Only this mind, which connects me with a false identity, the ego, and which connects me with attachments, is the cause of my happiness and distress." I might have said, given you this example before, but there, once I was in contact with a very famous actor, the most famous actor in Germany. He has left his body. His name is Georg Thomala. We were very close to each other. He actually took to the path of bhakti, and he had friends in the Mercedes-Benz company, and he told to one of the high-ranking chiefs that there's my friend Satchinandan Swami. He's a monk, he does good work, he travels and he gives lectures, he gives workshops and seminars tirelessly to uplift people. I think Mercedes-Benz should help him. And somehow, because he was so well known and liked, one of the chiefs, I don't think the ultimate chief, but one of the chiefs of Mercedes-Benz gave me a wonderful station wagon, almost new. It was only 1 year old and had been used for presenting this car to the customers, to satisfy their inquiry how such a station wagon is and so on. It was almost not used. So it was the first time in my life that I drove a decent car which was reliable, which would not stop on the autobahn or so on. And I must say, I developed some I felt good. Oh, finally, I can do what I have to do, and it works. The car works. It was maybe the first stages of deep attachment to the car. So I do remember my driver. I cannot drive, but my assistant, who also knows to drive and do all these practical things, parked the car. He got a parking place just before the place where I was giving my seminar. It was up in the third or fourth floor. And I was in the midst of the seminar when all of a sudden I heard a crunchy sound, you know. And I felt, oh no, someone has driven in the brand new Mercedes-Benz car and destroyed the only good car I ever saw in my life or had in my life. And I felt profound misery after all these years with these cars which always fall in disrepair at moments where you are absolutely dependent on them. I felt some grief because I had become identified with the with this car. I felt I was the owner of it and the user and so on. And, so I stopped the seminar. I gave the people some active thing, you know, turn to your partner and discuss this point. And then I went to the window. It was summer, I still remember, and looked down where the car was parked. And I saw it was not the Mercedes-Benz that had been crushed. It was a different car, two cars behind the Mercedes-Benz. And I remember my first feeling was, I'm perfectly honest, we have by now become a community. We should talk, straight talk. I felt some relief. But then I caught myself and thought, is this what you have learned? To feel happiness in distress based on something outside of you that is not you, of which you are totally separate, but which you make a connection due to attachment. And I felt ashamed. It was a good lesson for me. And I never forget the lesson. I'm grateful. This is what this Brahmana says here. Happiness and distress is only happening in the mind, which is identified. And genuine spiritual life manifests in becoming equipoised, both in happiness and in distress. You observe it as if you would be a video camera that observes a phenomena, an event, without any emotions. There is no attachment, no identification. There's just registrating going on. So in the same way, when you are spiritually situated, when you actually live the soul life, you will be able to go through the happinesses and distresses like this. You will say, interesting, my mind is feeling happiness. Interesting, my mind is thinking I should buy a purple car. Interesting, I feel my mind is feeling grief. But I am different from all this. And this gives you peace, real peace from the pangs of material existence or the constant flux of happiness and distress, which is there, which is unavoidable, which belongs to life as something inseparably. We want mostly happiness and we despise distress. But if you want happiness, you invite distress. Only little time is separated. It is said that as you advance in your spiritual life, not even the greatest catastrophe, which is when you lose everything with death, is bringing you away from that happiness, that happiness that is of a different category altogether. That happiness which is called ananda in Sanskrit, and which is not belonging to this flux of happiness and distress. It's not dependent on external things which are always in changing. So I would like to end today's session by bringing you into a state where you can maybe feel a little bit what that might be like. It will be, I will do it a little brisk. Let me just put my Ragini on. Let me turn to Hari Prasad or Ari and Michael, our sound people. Is it too loud, the sound I have put, or should it be louder or less loud? I can't hear you.
Good.
It's good like this. Good. So, ready to meditate, everyone? I can't hear you, nor can I see you, so I assume it is good. I request you to sit tall. Just find a good sitting position. The idea is that your spine should be straight. Maybe you quickly look left and right and look at the room or your environment where you are. And then when you are ready, please close your eyes. We will take a few deep and relaxed breaths. Do not strain yourself as you're breathing deeper. Just extend your breath a little bit. In other words, a long, smooth inhale and a long, smooth exhale, and so on. Whenever you inhale, do it gently. Your breath should be fine, just fine, gentle, slow and long inhales and exhales. Let's do this for a few breath circles. See that you have gentle, long in and exhales. Whenever you exhale, relax your body a little bit more. Start from the shoulders. your chest, your back, your legs. Whenever you exhale, relax your body a little more. Maintain a straight sitting position. Slowly and gradually let go whatever is going on in your life. Your job gone. Your various relationships gone. Your plans and worries, if there are any, gone. It's now you and your breath. Everything else is put on hold. Now I request you to bring your attention to your heart space. When you breathe in, imagine you are drawing your breath to the region of your heart. When you breathe into your heart space, maybe you feel a feeling of lightness. Of relief, maybe. Of relaxation. It is here in the heart space where the wisdom traditions say the self resides. Here the real you, the you that survives even physical death, is staying and residing. It is also here in the heart space where the Supreme Soul, the Super Soul, resides. Let us stay a little bit in this space, the sacred space, this safe space. We will do a few deep breaths again. We will slowly open our eyes and return back to room awareness. when I do these live meditations, sometimes people say, oh no, don't bring us back. When I had this experience which I shared with you, where I first very quickly was pulled through the tunnel and then came into this light, I felt I was in that sacred space. You can go there anytime. It takes maybe a little practice, but it is very nice, and you will see this is not empty. There's a lot going on in this space. First you become still in the material sense, but then you recognize this stillness is so rich. Good. I thank you very much. Let me look at my wristwatch. Oh, we are almost in time. We should congratulate ourselves. We are doing fine here. Thank you very much. I will give now the microphone back to our Ari, who will tell us how we will go on. Maybe you also, because sometimes our guests are not able to stay on for the question and answer session, you can maybe already announce the next programs, what it will be like, and so on.
Thank you, Satchinandan Swami. Thank you to everyone for being with us. So we will officially close the program here for those who need to leave, and next week we'll be back with a format of full questions and answers, and that will be the case for the next 3 weeks together. So we're really, really excited to have Satchinandan Swami back to answer a number of questions on the subject of being on the brink of death and how to contact the real self in spite of all obstacles. So thank you again, wishing all the best. And for those who can stay, we'll have another 25 minutes with Satchinandan Swami for questions and answers on this. All the best. So the first question comes from Shiva. Do you have any suggestions or tips for beginners in the spiritual process when they're facing unforgiving circumstances?
Unforgiving circumstances. It may be that I need a little bit priming here. Is it that you find yourself in a situation where you cannot forgive another person? Or what? I'm sorry, I'm not a native English speaker, and I do not understand what are unforgiving circumstances. Or maybe you can tell me what is an unforgiving circumstance.
Shiva, please.
Thank you, Swamiji. What I meant was that sometimes I feel that the whole world is kind of trying to put me down, in the sense that both materially and spiritually I'm not progressing anywhere. In that sense I feel that the circumstances are quite unforgiving.
Thank you very much. I thank you very much. Your question is now clear. Yes, whenever we feel overwhelmed by circumstances, it is really essential to step back. I learned this from the Bhagavad Gita, where it says that one should learn to observe the coming and going of happiness and distress, much like one will observe the coming and going of summer and winter seasons without becoming disturbed. And in the fifth chapter of the Gita, there is another instruction how to come into this observer role. But it really made a lot of sense to me only when I read a quotation of Leonardo da Vinci. Sometimes you need a little prompting from outside. Leonardo da Vinci, amongst all the other genius things he did, is best known as a painter. He painted a few very, very well acclaimed paintings. For instance, The Last Supper. And he said, it is good sometimes to step back, because from the distance, more can be taken in one glance. And you can see where your work lacks harmony and proportion. Then, after having stepped back and gotten new perspectives, you can come close again and correct your work wherever it requires correction. So, when we are overwhelmed by circumstances, like this situation which I described to you, where I was overwhelmed by pain and then this experience of starting to leave the body, the only thing which really still helped me a little bit is to step back. What I did, I didn't want to tell this in such detail. I imagined myself, you know, as the pain mounted up, to be out of my body and looking at my hospital bed from underneath the ceiling and taking some distance. And it did work. But as I told you, this were exceptionally trying situation. I was trying to go through a pain which requires sedation medically by reducing it, the medication significantly, as if I would no longer take. It was so small, the doses, that I, because I know as a monk, I would like to have all my spiritual faculties fully with me and my mental strengths with me at the time of death, so that I can direct my thoughts in the best way I know of, and in this way have a glorious death, a departure, which brings me to a very wonderful next destination. So I wanted very much to have that that type of thing. I don't recommend it to anyone. I just described to you an experience. But most of the time, we don't have these type of tests, these types of being overwhelmed. So step back, make some space, and fill the space with wisdom, with a different perspective that allows you to see things differently, that allows you to detach also and find so that you are no longer so affected. Wisdom helps you to cut the knot that binds you to this happiness and distress. You can also do, if you are already doing a spiritual practice, you can put everything on hold and focus on your spiritual practice. And there are many, many people who have done this, who have been able to deal with very difficult situations in their lives. Thank you. Is there another question?
Yes. Thank you. We have from Bruno. Where do you think you were in that place of light? What does it mean? And where was the other door leading? I'll ask once more. Where do you think you were in that place of light? What does it mean? And where was the other door leading?
According to my training, I have entered what is called in Sanskrit the Brahman. It's an undifferentiated energy and light filled situation. When you have the material world, which is full of material differences, there's a valley, there's a forest, there's New York, there's an alley, there is Manhattan, there is Times Square, there is, you know, so many things which are there, the River Hudson. Good, when all, this is called the material variety. When you enter the spiritual reality, that material reality is no longer manifest. You have crossed beyond it. You see a type of undifferentiated oneness. It is the only comparison which we have in the human language is with light, energy-filled light. So many, many spiritual traditions talk about this, and when they talk about their respective spiritual realizations, their extrasensual perceptions, they will usually bring in the imagery of light. When we hear of saints who are realized, we always see a circle of light around their heads. In Christian tradition, in Sufi traditions, in Hindu traditions, in shamanistic traditions, they all know about the light, and those who are a bit more realized, it is said they carry that light with them, and therefore in paintings the artist will paint a circle which rests on the shoulder around this person who has entered that spiritual reality and comes from there. Now, beyond this reality, there is what the Vedas describe as Param Brahman, that is, which is Parama, or beyond even Brahma. It's a spiritual world which is made of Sat, of eternality, causeless knowledge, and bliss. These are the building blocks of that spiritual variety. It's here where our material mind has to say, I can't grasp this. I can understand that elements build up the variety, and when you break down the variety, you have the elements. But elements made of bliss, made of knowledge, made of eternal being, that I have not experienced in this world. Yes, you have not experienced, because this is in the world of matter, where everything is made of lumps of matter, either gross or subtle. But so where was I? I was in the waiting room of God, and the door had just opened a little bit. I hope I said properly, there was a crack in the door. It had just opened, not a crack in the door. What is it called in English when the door just opens a little bit? Please.
Yeah, crack is good, or it was just a little slightly ajar.
Yeah. So something of that eternal reality came out in the form of this amazing light. But if I would have been allowed to enter into the door, I would not just have seen light. I would have also seen light, but I would have seen divine beings full of bliss, moving around and dance, like movements, different movements, in other words, than the movements which we use when we walk down the Fifth Avenue. I would have seen amazing exchanges of divine love, but as the voice said, not yet, not yet, not yet, because someone who goes there will not return to the world of birth and death any longer. You can only come from that undifferentiated waiting room, so to say, that Brahman, where you see only light, there's only one aspect of the spiritual reality. From there you can come back into the material world, not from the world of eternal variety. It was not yet my time. That's all right. I can wait. I don't think this is under the human being's dominion. We can't force our entry there. We can't be gate crashers there. Thank you. The wonderful questions you asked. Is there another question? Maybe the last question which we will deal with for today?
Yes. So I actually have a question for you. I remember very vividly when this was happening, and I was at that time a monk myself, and I was praying and praying and praying, and I was crying. I was very upset, not knowing whether we would have you back. And I was thinking, as you were speaking, just about what it would have been if you didn't make it. And how that would have changed my life. So I'm very grateful, first of all, that you did make it out, and I just wanted to express what that was for me. And my question is, I remember also that there was quite a long period of recovery, and I wanted to ask you about the aftermath. If you could take us into the epilogue, what was that recovery like for you, and how did your experience inform your recovery? In other words, how did your contacting that place of being as a soul in that other dimension inform your recovery?
You remember correctly. There was this initial joy to have made the, to have conquered really the sepsis, or that the sepsis was no longer there. But it was a long recovery, because such a type of sepsis or infection takes a toll on organs, on processes like digestion, on sleep. You know, it's a fever which is, in my case, a nerve fever also. You see, you're more emotional, easier emotional. It is, the body and mind are really affected by it. But I do remember, for some days I could not really move. I was sitting in a seat like this, and the food was brought to me. And I had minimal movements. I could move. It was no longer the pain in the leg, but I was just absolutely weak. And but I was so strong in my mind after this experience. I was reading a lot. I was not, you know, I have this practice of meditation on a mantra. I was not doing this very much because I was very weak physically, and also I couldn't keep my mind so much focused on the mantra as I do now. But reading worked wonderful, and also hearing. And my good friend, Professor Midvedic, came a few times, and he read to me from books, and we discussed. I was outside very fragile, and inside very very good. Eventually, I went to the Bosnian mountains, where there is said there's a lot of good air. I took a cabin in a ski resort, but there was no one there because it was summer. There was no tourists up there. And yes, I learned the art of meditation there. I read in the Vedic scriptures the material on meditation and applied it, and became very, very peaceful. I had to learn walking again with that leg, and I went with these sticks, you know, where I could keep my balance, and walked. In the epilogue or the aftermath, I wrote a book which I believe is spiritually, it's about a spiritual practice, very powerful. It is called Nam Rahasya. It has a Sanskrit title. And I studied very deeply my tradition. I took the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu with me. Yes, and I somehow developed something which has not left me since then. I had understood I'm an eternal soul, and so is everywhere. The soul is everywhere. Life is everywhere. And I remember I would be in my cabin, and in the night, wild horses came because they felt maybe a spiritual person is there. And they went under a tree, and I opened the window and I said, "Okay, guys," I learned this in New York, this language, "okay, guys, I will now switch off the light. You better find your sleeping places now, because you won't be able to see anything." And somehow there was a communication. Everyone listened. Okay, he's going to turn off the light, and they all moved. It was, after some time, 50, you know, horses and cows also, which were high up there grazing. And I developed this ability to communicate with all life. That was a gift afterwards. When I would walk, for instance, I remember I met a white wolf. I had been warned, there are wolves up here, and when you meet the white wolf, he is somehow very bitter with human beings and he attacks. So once I was walking, and very majestically this animal, this white wolf, steps on my path. And I greet him joyfully, Hari Bol. He looks at me, and you know, there he is powerful. He can. You don't want to have any aggressive action on his part. And he just looked at me, and he felt at ease with me. I felt at ease with him. I said, "Would you like to accompany walking?" But he disappeared in the forest. I can't speak complicated things, but just things like "I wish you well" and things like that. Or "I'm turning off the light, better go and find your sleeping place." Simple things. But it has never left me. When I sit and chant, animals come and they are peaceful around me and I'm peaceful around them. I have gone one step further in my life. Because as I said, death forces us to deal or to think about our own immortality, or it makes our eternal self shine forth. Thank you for bringing this out of me. I'm a little bit shy to talk about these things, but since you asked, I would suggest I will stop here. I also am using the I had to bring my hosts. I had to all take them out of this room to do this call. And I should now take care of them. And our time is over. I'm very, very happy to have done this. I want to greet all of you affectionately. I still see the wonderful smile of our Rasanath, Hari Bol. We will meet. I will come this summer to New York, and then I will have to see your child. And Michael is there. And hiya, our Vrindavan Vinodini. Long time I have not seen you. And you used to be in the an unofficial member of my spiritual music band, and good. And here are so many others. Nice that you could still stay with us. Oh, Gail is there. Yes, I remember you. The ever joyful. Yes.
So sweet to hear you today.
Same. And our Rukmini is there. Rukmini will be initiated in the sacred Vaishnava tradition. Yes. And all of New York wonders, what will her name be? Fine, but I see many of you. Oh, I feel honored. And Scott is also there. Hello, Scott. And very, very nice. Chandu and Anand Goyal. Oh. Very, very wonderful. I thank you all, and let us have a nice question and answer session. You know, in India, there's something like to prime the pump. There are these pumps which go really deep, and when you go to them and want to pump something out of them, there's only sound, but no water coming. So what you need to do is to bring water from another source of water, pour it into the pump, and then when you do the pumping motion, it can pull up water from the ground. So priming the pump is something which you need to know in India. I think our Bal Krishna, You know this art. I want to prime your pump a little bit. We will engage in a lively question and answer session. I think I would say a little bit in the beginning to keep us all thinking. And then it's as good if you have your questions ready. Maybe now, if there's something which you would like to explore together with me, maybe now, if you're primed up now, It's good to write it down. It wouldn't be nice if I say any questions and you all look with happiness into your computer and have no question. No, please, to make it lively, go to these questions which are a little existential maybe, and if you feel comfortable in this community to talk, to ask these private personal questions, please do so. Otherwise you can in some way go to a deep place and dig out some questions, and please do it beforehand. Come with your questions on a piece of paper to the call, and then we can do. I can always talk. I could also talk about a few other life-threatening situations. I will prepare myself and remember a few more, because inside of me there's a little adventurer, and therefore I sometimes... My dear mother always says, you didn't know where your limits are as a child, and maybe this is still with you a little bit. You're a little bit daring and bold. So good. Fine, I will end here, but please, Ari, you please do the last words.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and we'll also have questions from the community that we'll have prepared as well. So we're very much looking forward to next week and the next 3 weeks together in dialogue with you, Sachinandan Swami. Thank you so much for sharing what you did today. It was very powerful.